Welcome to Passing Years CAM Podcast, Conversations on Aerodigestive Management. This episode of CAM features your host, Dr. Kristen King, and guests, Shane Harper and Buffy Buchanan, having a conversation about trach tube selection and valve use.
I want to welcome everyone to another podcast with the Conversations on Aerodigestive Management, the CAM podcast. We're here today with Buffy Buchanan and Shane Harper from Northwest Texas Hospital in Amarillo, Texas. And they are a center of excellence. We'll touch on that maybe a little bit as we chat. But I want to tell you a little bit about Buffy and Shane, and then I'll let them provide a little more information on themselves. Buffy Buchanan is a speech-language pathologist with over 20 years of experience, and she is the clinical supervisor and speech-language pathologist there at the hospital. It is a level 3 trauma center, and she has had a lead role in developing their tracheostomy team and maintaining data collection and quality improvement processes there at their facility. So we're going to have a little fun talking with Buffy today. And then we also have with us Shane Harper, who is a physician assistant and the medical director of the surgical intensive care unit at Northwest Texas Hospital. He is a recognized as a distinguished fellow by the American Academy of Physician Assistants. And interestingly, his background was in respiratory therapy before he went into being a physician assistant. At least he had his BS in respiratory care, which brings a nice perspective, I think, to working with patients with tracheostomies. Shane and Buffy, I want to thank both of you so much for coming on today and chatting with me. Do you have anything you'd like to add about your backgrounds or your hospital? Anything you feel like people should know?
We're definitely busy here at the hospital, both administratively and clinically. But it's of no concern to anybody else. I feel like I do think it's important to know that even though we're a level 3 trauma facility, we do cover a large geographical area, being here in Amarillo. So roughly 2,700 traumas a year get admitted to Northwest. We definitely, cover everything from Northern Texas Panhandle, Southern Kansas, Oklahoma Panhandle, Southeast Colorado when the weather's bad. So we are kind of isolated here on a little island as far as geographical medical availability would per se entail. And for that reason, I feel like, we do have enough patients to make a difference with our tracheostomy care and are given the ability to, trach and see plenty of those people as they come through our doors.
Yeah, that's definitely a large catchment area when you're covering that many different states, counties, and the surrounding areas, like you mentioned. So thank you for clarifying that. Well, one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you both, first of all, you're a center of excellence, a passing year center of excellence. Buffy, you took a lead role in submitting that application and all. Can you tell me a little bit about what you and your team do there at Northwest that caused you to think, hey, we should apply to be a center of excellence?
Well, we've always been the ones responsible for placing the speaking valves on those 8 patients initially, but we saw a great need to try and make that happen faster, to be more effective, and just our process and our protocol. And so that's, we kind of came together to create the center, to apply for center of excellence and try to streamline that process just to make some improvements.
Well, I know one of the things that we liked about your facility as being a center of excellence is you're not involved in just the patient care, although it's all related, but you also collect the data. I mentioned, you have process improvements in place, you collect data, and you publish periodically on what you're doing with your patients there. And it's really good for being able to disseminate that information and for people to see what you're doing at your facility. One of the things I'd like to talk with you both about is your early intervention program and just how quickly you could get people into the ICU, not patients, but the clinicians, the speech language pathologists, and get people into the ICU. And one of the things that you shared with me that contributed to that was using fenestrated tracheostomy tubes with your patients. We get asked a lot about the use of fenestrated tracheostomy tubes and are they required in order to use a speaking valve? And they're not required to be able to use a speaking valve. However, they certainly could potentially provide some benefit, which I think y'all found there. Shane, do you mind sharing a little bit about your choice as, working with these patients of why you would go to the fenestrated tracheostomy tube and what you've been finding by doing that?
Yeah. So what we discovered is, you know, majority of our tracheostomy patients were trauma patients. So these were people who, you know, suffered a traumatic brain injury, be it, you know, motor vehicle accident, farming or ranching industry accidents. And we didn't have that classic patient per se, where, you know, a little old lady with pneumonia who, you know, went into respiratory failure, went a couple of weeks on the vent, and then the decision was made to, you know, go towards a tracheostomy. So our look at the patient was kind of more, okay, we have a trauma patient. There may or may not be multiple surgical interventions for that patient. And we wanted to get them, you know, off the ventilator as quickly as possible. So that's why we, you know, when we, me and Buffy talked about it, and really the decision we decided to go towards was, you know, you, like you say, you don't need a fenestrated trach, but, you know, once we got to a point where we were taking people off the ventilator, we found that with a cuff fenestrated trach, we did have better communication once we put the passenger on. Now, we stayed with a cuff trach because some of these people were going back and forth to the OR, and, you know, to keep the trach in place and not have that manipulated by anesthesia or wanting to put an endotracheal tube back in or whatnot, we just stayed with that cuff trach. And that way, if we had an incident or something happened or they went back to the OR, it was just a simple, you know, reinflate the cuff, let them go under general anesthesia. And then as soon as they came back, we, you know, immediately went back to where they were, deflating the cuff, back to, you know, trach collar, passing mirror valve trials as quickly as possible. Now, you know, our protocol right now says that we're going to use a, you know, 6 or 8 shyly fenestrated cuff trach, which we've had good luck with. I know there's other trachs out there in the world, different brands and whatnot. In my opinion, I kind of feel like it's a Chevy versus Ford thing. You know, what do you feel most comfortable with? How have you had good luck with them? We've had good luck with the shylies. I can't complain about them. You know, we've had no big incidents or problems with them. I think if you choose your trach appropriately, you know, in the OR, we do a lot of our trachs either open or in a hybrid model with the Blue Rhino. But one thing about it is we usually get down to the trachea where we can actually see the size of the trachea itself. And it was very surprising, you know, in my career, you usually find the bigger the person is, the smaller their trach is, it seems like. So, you know, you have a little, you know, guy, 18, 22 years old fella, and you'll look at that trach and he's easily an 8 trach all day long. And then you get a large person and get down to their trach and you think, man, a 6 is going to be tight, but it's never what you think it is, I feel like. And I feel like seeing the trachea itself, being able to make that decision operatively to say, okay, this looks definitely more suitable for a 6, where we thought, you know, an 8 would definitely be what they need, and vice versa. You know, we just, you always get surprised sometimes. I feel like that makes a big difference because then we're not ramrodding a trach in there, you know, one that's too big, and conversely one that, you know, may be too small and we don't get quite as much benefit out of if we'd gone with a bigger trach. But we immediately, you know, as they get back from the OR after a tracheostomy placement, as soon as we wake them up, we start taking them off that ventilator, start the trach collar trials if it, you know, they can tolerate it. And then if they wear out, we'll put them back on the ventilator. I usually call Buffy either leaving the OR or shortly thereafter and, you know, hey, Mrs. So-and-so, I kind of gave you a heads up about her. We got the trach in. This is what we got. This is how it was. Buffy or one of the speech pathologists, they're usually coming by that afternoon just to kind of eyeball them, see where they're at, how are they doing. And then 7 o'clock the next morning, you know, it's, if they can do it, you know, let's start slapping the passing mirror on and see how we do with it. Now, we don't always have great success. You know, not everybody's talking post-op day one, but a majority of people are. And I think the aggressive nature of it is we feel like we can always go back to being ventilated if we need to. We can always safely take a step back, but we're going to try to take 2 steps forward. And if, you know, we take 2 steps forward and we fall on our face, that's fine. Let's back it up. Let them rest on the ventilator, maybe 4 hours on, 4 hours off. But we are aggressively trying to get them off that ventilator. From a patient perspective, I feel like one of the benefits that we did not anticipate was patient satisfaction and then also family satisfaction. So, you know, you have these patients, they've been through a horrible trauma, they're banged up, they're busted, and just getting them back from the OR, getting all that stuff off their face. You know, now you got the tube holder off. Conversely, if they go for a trach, we usually do a peg. So now you're getting all the tubes out of their mouth and nose, and now they look like the patient. Come back all the time and parents say, okay, he looks like John or she looks like Susie. So it brings a personal element to the family. And then the family, the patient themselves, you know, they'll come back to clinic and see us. And out of all the things that, you know, they may have had done to them, their one complaint is, why didn't you guys treat me earlier? And that's always surprising because, you know, we talk to families about, hey, we're going to do a trach. It's not permanent. You know, give them the normal spiel about a trach. And of course, everyone's hesitant. They think you've taken a step backwards. They don't really see it as an evolution. But you get those people back and they come back and they go, look, do you know how annoying it is not to be able to close your mouth? Do you know how the constant sensation of an endotracheal tube is? And so that's their one argument. You know, not that their legs are busted or, you know, they now even may have an ostomy or something crazy like that. It's the day after we did the trach, that's when, you know, I really felt like things were getting better. And then just being able to communicate with the patient, at least now, you know, if they're not doing the passive mirror valve, you know, adequately, they're able to read lips. So it's always tough to try to read lips when somebody's got a water hose sticking out of their mouth. But now with the trach, you know, now you can start reading lips, you get a little talented at it. And then, of course, as soon as you hear their voice for the first time, or they can hear their own voice, or the family hears their voice, you know, that's a big deal. And usually that's a day that people say, okay, you know, we had a good day because of this. You know, this was a milestone day because of this. I do know, you know, we've had some traveling physicians, residents come through, nurses and whatnot, especially with the COVID pandemic. And they kind of saw our protocol and thought, man, you guys, you know, this is way too aggressive. And then by the time they leave the hospital, they're, you know, hey, can we get a copy of y'all's protocol? We want to take it back to where we came from. And like I say, I feel that we are very, very aggressive compared to most of the world, but it's a safe, you know, you have a safety net. You're not going out on a limb and just willy-nilly extubating or pulling tubes. You have a safety net. And I think that's the comfort we all take in it. You know, like I say, if somebody falls on their face, it's no big deal. We just take a step back and regroup and start over.
One thing you mentioned in there, and I'm going to unpack a couple of points from it. Going back to the OR, you talked about sizing the tracheostomy tube in the sense of, you know, getting a look at the airway and making a determination on the size of the trach tube, which I think I just wanted to kind of go back to that for just a moment, because it's a critical piece that we get asked a lot, because some places it's just slap an 8 in, you know, that didn't matter the size of the patient or the size of the airway, I should say. And that everybody just gets a number 8. And so you were saying that you take a look at the airway and gauge the size of the tracheostomy tube. So you don't necessarily start with a number 8. A patient may get a size 6 tracheostomy tube to start.
Yeah, it all depends on the patient, you know, and like I say, sometimes you'll get down to that airway and you'll look at it and, you know, you expect that airway to be a little bigger than your thumb. And all of a sudden you find something that's, you know, the size of your pinky, and you can go back. And I used to go back and kind of try to size airways off of CTs and that sort of stuff. But with our practice, I just feel like if you ram an 8 into everybody and all of a sudden get an 8 in there, it may be a little tight. But you get an 8 in, then you go to, you know, start your trials, you let your cuff down, and it's just like, well, how much room are we truly giving that person? You know, how much room is around that trach for air to pass? And I think that also would advocate for going straight to a fenestrated tube. Because if you did, you know, have a tube that was a little full, quote unquote, for the trachea, at least you have the fenestration to kind of help offset that a little bit. I feel like people that ramrod those tubes, you know, everybody getting an 8, getting an 8, getting an 8, take the time to, you know, get down, dissect down, look at that trach. It's just, there's a lot of times you just think, oh, this person, you know, they'll take an 8 all day long. You look at their trach itself and you think, man, no wonder we didn't have a cuff leak with that, you know, 7, 7.5 tube. It's occluding the whole trachea itself. So yes, we have gone straight to 6s, and that does not stop Buffy and her team, you know, the next day. 6, 4, it wouldn't matter. You know, they would start just like anybody else. And to be honest with you, it's usually that person has an 8. It's not a week later that Buffy will come to me and say, hey, I know we're only a week out. Our sutures only came out a couple of days ago, but can we downsize? This 8's just too much for them. It's, I feel like we'd get more benefit if we could downsize to a 6. So it's very rare, even if they get an 8, that they're not downsized to a 6. Thank God we have a great respiratory therapy team that can do that at the bedside for us, get that downsized, and they just continue to progress and you know, really make leaps and bounds. Because after that, Buffy's usually coming to you saying, hey, can we start capping trials? And so I think our total tracheostomy days are much, much less than the national average because that aggressive nature in that regard. We don't wait 2 weeks to, you know, some people say, well, we need to wait 2 weeks before we even change out a trait. If everything's been going well, you know, there was anything surgically to make us say, you know, we have to wait, we'll do it a week out. You know, we'll downsize that if we can. And like I say, we have a great respiratory therapy staff that can do that. But again, you know, you say, well, we took the 8 out, we couldn't get the 6 in. No one needs to panic. We have the airway cart there. We're just going to re-intubate them. You know, we'll get it fixed. It's not the end of the world if you don't let it be. It's the airway. It's scary. It needs to be taken with a little bit of care. But if you have somebody there, it can intubate. You can switch out the trachs. And I'll, you know, knock on wood, as long as we've been doing this, I don't think we've ever had an issue. No, we've ever had an issue where somebody, you know, needed to be emergently re-intubated by respiratory therapy or us and run back down to the ICU. So we've gotten away with it, but I do think it's made a big difference in our practice to actually look at that trach in the OR and make that determination.
Yeah, I think that was a really important point I wanted to kind of bring us back to, because I think the size and the proper spacing and fit of that tracheostomy tube can make a big difference. But Buffy, that brings me to you with the second part of something I wanted to kind of unpack from what Shane said earlier. So generally speaking, people think of using a speaking valve 48 to 72 hours after the tracheostomy. There's research published out of Johns Hopkins from 21 where they said 24 hours or less for placing a speaking valve. And it sounds like you're getting in pretty early. Can you share a little bit about what you're doing?
We are. Like Shane said, he usually calls us and says, hey, we're on our way back. We will come and look at them immediately. Usually when they get back from the OR, that doesn't mean we're going to do it that day. It's purely, you know, based on the patient, each patient. But I would say within 24 hours, we're going to attempt, whether that's in line or when they're on trach collar.
Can you share a little about the criteria that you use? Like when you get that call and you go up to the room to check on them, like what are you looking for to decide whether or not you may try it that day, or if you're going to wait till the next day, or what are some things you use to help make that decision?
Again, I think, you know, it's patient by patient. If you want to kind of wrap it all up, I think if you're looking at a patient that's, you're going to be placing in line on the vent, we do have a protocol, our parameters set, you know, their peak should be this on a spontaneous rate. We want to make sure they're at those parameters. We want to make sure they're awake and alert and attempting to communicate. A lot of times those patients are also head injury or stroke patients. And so we do have neurocognitive things going on as well. If they're on trach collar, we usually attempt if they're on trach collar. If they're, you know, don't have a lot of secretions, we can get their cuff deflated, and if they can tolerate that step, then we're going to attempt the pacemaker that day. Thing would be swelling and bleeding, that sort of thing post-op.
What have you found are some of the benefits of getting in sooner? And I'm asking that from a speech pathology standpoint in regards, you know, some people share they can't get in. Some facilities they're told, you know, until they're weaned completely from the ventilator, they don't want them getting involved because it could slow down the wean. That's one thing we've heard. Or people say they wait until they're, you know, on trach collar. But what are some of the advantages or points that you have found with getting in sooner and at least checking them, even if you're not using a valve with them, at least getting in there earlier to assess kind of their status?
Well, I think for one, at least showing your face, like Shane said earlier, just for family to see that you're there and you're attempting, the patient to know you're attempting to help them communicate, just that improves patient experience itself, can help with anxiety for the patient.
As far as that goes, I think, you know, a lot of trauma patients tend to be young males, you know, 18 to 35. They're, you know, no man is a good patient. I can say that as a man. And especially, you know, intubated, tied down, you know, when you start talking about that sort of stuff, people, they want to get the tube out. They want to be upset, and rightfully so, because it is alien abduction, right? There's tubes and lines going everywhere. You can't talk. You're tied down. The fact that once we get a trach in them, you know, that alleviates a lot of it. But then when they can talk, you know, when people feel like they have a voice, it's not veterinary medicine anymore. I think, you know, we've gone from people being on drips to calm agitation. As soon as you can put the pacemaker on, they can talk. They feel so more engaged in their own care. And it's usually the most random things that you find out they're upset about. You know, hey, my nose has been itching for 4 days and nobody will scratch it and I can't scratch it. well, somebody let me scratch my nose. And then all of a sudden the patient takes a 180 in their entire clinical course because they're able to bring forth their thoughts and ideas and convey what their problems are. I think Buffy's exactly right, though. Being there, showing the family their face, providing the literature we provide, you know, this is the next step. This is what we're going to be doing tomorrow morning. So everybody kind of has a plan. And of course, nursing does. And they know, you know, hey, speech is going to be here in the morning. We're not going to be starting a first ed drip so somebody can go eat lunch. You know, we're going to keep that person awake, alert. Therefore, we have success and everyone agrees with that. And then these people are leaving the ICU. I would say the people that say, you know, you have to wait, you have to wait, you have to wait. What exactly are we waiting on? Mm-hmm. You know, that's my big question is, Buffy brought up a lot of stuff that they look at. I call it just the eyeball test. You know, you can tell right off the bat, is this person going to fly or not fly? But, you know, what are we waiting on? Because again, you always have a safety net, and that's just to put them back on the ventilator if need be. But there's no reason, I feel like, to wait, because you're just prolonging your ICU stays, prolonging your ventilator days. You know, that's what our original research was about, was, okay, we're aggressive, but this is how much money we saved. This is how much time we saved, because it's always been that theory of, you know, wait, wait, wait. You guys are too aggressive. You're making it breathe or die. But I think we found that the regimen does work, and being aggressive is not as aggressive as we thought it was in the past. I've had patients that literally, we came out of the OR, slapped a trach collar on them, and we didn't have a passing mirror on them, but, you know, we were deflating cuffs and occluding, and these guys were talking. Why waiting 24, 48 hours sometimes isn't always the right answer, I feel like. Now, it's not every answer, but there is patients I think you can definitely push the envelope with.
Yeah, well, I think you've both made the point that you have to look at the individual patient. There's not a blanket cookie cutter approach to all of them, because you've got to look at each one's needs. I will share, because you mentioned the research and your findings about cost savings and everything. You shared that information in an article with us for Era Digestive Health in our 2021 issue. So I'll share, you know, you both authored an article that shares some of those findings that you had with the earlier intervention. So I'll share that in case people are interested in looking at that. Buffy, with the getting in earlier with the patient, what about from a swallowing standpoint? When do you decide to start looking at swallowing or potentially getting them back to PO? Again, I know it's individual as far as the patient goes, but what's your kind of general process?
We typically try to do, say we do the passing mirror assessment within 24 hours. We try to do a swallow assessment within another 24 to 48 hours. I would say overall, yep. Obviously it's patient by patient, depending on, you know, stroke, head injury, but we try to at least do an assessment. They may not be ready for PO, but at least we've done an assessment and we can start. We have goals and can start working on swallowing.
So when you're looking at swallowing, do you do instrumentals that early, or are you doing just a clinical bedside swallow that early? And then
typically we're doing just a bedside swallow evaluation that early. And then if we will proceed with usually like a FEES in the ICU at bedside.
How quickly, I know this is, again, it's a kind of broad question and it can be patient specific, but how quickly would you say you're able sometimes to get these patients back to PO? Do you have just kind of like, I know it's all over the place, but do you think you're getting in there pretty early and being aggressive?
Yes, we are. It's all over the place, but there are some that come back from the OR that do so well with the passing mirror. They're eating within 48 hours and maybe a modified diet, but we are definitely more aggressive than where we could have been.
And I'm asking that because that's another area from a swallowing standpoint that sometimes people will hold off on PO until until either they're talking and using the valve successfully, or they'll hold off until they're completely weaned and not needing a ventilator at all, because they think PO is going to, again, Shane, kind of the PO is going to cause some setback in that weaning process. What would you say if you had to give advice to other hospitals and clinicians in other hospitals, physicians in other hospitals, as far as progressing their patients with tracheostomies quickly? What would be one area that you'd say something they need to either establish or do that they may find helpful?
I think just having a team, like what we established, is what makes the biggest difference. Getting everyone on the same page and having that common goal to move the patient forward, speaking, swallowing, like that makes a huge difference. Having the collaboration is
you definitely have to have buy-in from, you know, respiratory therapy is going to buy in immediately, but getting buy-in from nursing, you know, and saying, okay, look, I know this is how we did it 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but, you know, this is how we're doing it now. And once you get the buy-in, like Buffy's saying, from everybody, everybody kind of sees the common goal. That's a big thing. And trying to change the way people have practiced for decades, finding the right patient population, you know, maybe not, you know, all comers at first, but let's take a subset of patients that we feel pretty good about. So let's say isolated, you know, head patients, and then kind of work our way out. You don't need somebody with a bazillion problems and say, okay, this is going to be patient number one for our facility as we, you know, try to do this, this, and this. Kind of a, you know, work yourself into it. Feel like kind of we did that with traumatic brain injury patients, and they were usually young males. Kind of worked our way into it, and to the point we felt like, okay, we got some caveats figured out. Now let's open it up, you know, really start saying everybody can do this, knowing that you may run into a couple of roadblocks in some patient populations. But starting off slow, I think, you know, we kind of started off slow when Buffy kind of came to me and said, hey, what do you think about this? And I said, okay, we'll try it. You know, we didn't just start and say everybody's going to get, you know, this regimen. But it wasn't very long after that that we kind of said, okay, we definitely see the benefit. Let's start, you know, pushing it a little bit harder.
You know, it's funny because I didn't prep you for that question and you went exactly where I was hoping, Buffy, which was to say to have a team, because I think working with tracheostomy patients, it is a very structured team approach. And Shane, I think you're bringing up a really nice point about starting with a smaller subset of a patient population. Like, it doesn't have to be every patient in the hospital to start with. You can start with a subset and get your protocols established and your staff trained and, you know, get everybody familiar with the process. And I think that's a really nice point to add on there. Do you do team rounds or tracheostomy rounds?
We do respiratory and speech round on each tracheostomy patient at least once a week together.
And so that's a good time where you can discuss kind of what's going on with the patient or what the plan is. Can you give a rundown, a little bit of a rundown of what rounds look like? That's something I'm finding some people don't do. They may have a team, but they don't do rounds.
Now, our rounds is speech and RT. We round on each patient once a week, and we have a sheet that we complete on every patient we round on. And we're looking for things like sutures. We have, you know, within our protocol, sutures come out on a certain day. So we're looking to make sure sutures are out. We're checking the trach site for any wounds, skin breakdown, that sort of thing, consulting wound care if we need them to come in. We're just checking, obviously, PO, are they on tube feeding? Is speech working with them on swallowing? And then we're looking to see if they have active physical, occupational, or speech therapy orders. Are they appropriate? And that's something that we can put orders in to start getting the other therapies involved if the patient appears to be ready for that. And then discharge plans, we do look at kind of discharging because here in the hospital, we do have our surgical ICUs and our floors, but we also have our 15-bed rehab. So we also look at, you know, patients that may benefit coming to rehab and what they're going to need from discharge.
Well, thank you. I think that gives a nice kind of little overview of trach rounds. And I know the GTC, the Global Tracheostomy Collaborative, that's something that they also recommend facilities have in place, are tracheostomy rounds. Is there anything that either of you would like to share, or you feel like this is something, you know, I didn't say, or something about working with patients with tracheostomies you think is important for people to know about or make note of?
Like I say, I'll just reiterate, if you have an aggressive group, you know, very contemporary group of providers and clinicians, I do think it's worth testing the waters a little bit and really kind of making strides to get your patients trached appropriately, but then off the ventilator as quickly as possible. You know, we've enjoyed the success with our group because it has been a tight group, and there's been, you know, a lot of spearheading, but a lot of that came from administration. You know, as soon as we went to them and said, look, guys, we're doing this and these are the results we're seeing. You know, the C-suite doesn't care about anything except money half the time, I feel like. And so in today's world, you know, it's all about dollars and cents. And even if you can cut down, you know, your ventilator days one day, your ICU day by one day, that adds up. You know, that adds up very, very quickly, especially if you have a decent ICU. And those are the type of things that'll get everybody on board real quick. And that's kind of where we've been, I feel like, is just try it. We kind of stepped out and swam in the deep water a little bit and found a lot more freedom out there. It wasn't as scary as everyone thinks it would or will be. But at the same time, you have some some results. You know, it makes it all worth it. And then lastly, you know, besides the dollars and cents, just the patience. I feel like really it's a big deal when you can't talk or you can't communicate. Everybody's goal in this ICU, it seems like for the most part, is, hey, let's get them to where, let's hear what Mr. Jones's voice says, you know, instead of us sitting here trying to read lips for 20 minutes and him getting frustrated, something that can be dealt with in 10 seconds, like a normal person. I think we have a much higher patient satisfaction, our trach patients, than we did, say, 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. If you were to go back and ask them from then and now. And I think, honestly, it makes everybody's job a little bit easier. And that's hard for people to kind of think, you know, well, you're building a team, you're doing more work. Yes and no, because once you get that team in place, things are going smoothly, you have your protocol, you really are making it easier. Nobody calls me to get orders to get sutures out. It's in the protocol. You know, no one has to call Buffy for, you know, a swallow eval. It's in the protocol. And really, it gets people moving along. And so in that regard, it does make less work once you kind of fine tune and get everything ironed out. But the big thing is saying you're going to start it and actually try it.
Yeah. So do you have an order set that goes with your protocol?
You know, we have it on there to where everybody knows these things are going to happen on these days. And it does work out, I feel like. You know, if I round on one of our patients in the ICU and they still have sutures in on day five, you know, I want to find out, okay, has respiratory been bided yet? Why haven't these sutures come out? Why haven't we done this? Why haven't we done that? Because everybody knows this is the culture. This is how it's been put in place. No one has an excuse. If you're eating ice cream, that's your only excuse, right? You're not helping this patient. You know, once you get to that point and you get things in place, it does make life so much easier.
Yeah, the protocols definitely help with everybody being on the same page and, you know, kind of knowing what's coming next. Buffy, I'm going to end with one last question for you. You mentioned that you and respiratory therapy rounding, you know, speech pathology and respiratory rounding. How did you get, do you have like one piece of advice or information on how you got speech and respiratory on the same page and working together for rounds and all?
It's a collaborative effort.
It's a collaborative. I mean, I had the right RT at the time when we started to put this team together. And I think both of us had the same common goal in mind to help the patient, just to help the patient communicate faster and wean them faster. And, you know, just communicating with one another. These are the concerns that I see when I see these patients. And these are the concerns RT sees. And so we kind of collaborate together to come up with the things we're going to round on.
No, I think that's a good point. I mean, having the communication and the common goal is what kind of helps, I think, bring everybody together. And I think that's probably a good point to end on. I appreciate the time that both of you spent with me and answering questions and sharing with all of the listeners about what you're doing, some of what you're doing with working with patients with tracheostomies. And I like the more aggressive approach, Shane. That's one reason I wanted to talk with both of you. I was really impressed when I was out there. And I like that you seem to be moving your patients, you know, faster than I hear in some facilities. And so I think it's something everybody can learn from. So thank you both for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CAM. We are happy to offer continuing education credit through ASHA for this podcast. To receive credit, please go to www.passymuir.com/podcast and click on the continuing education link under this episode. Then you will either create an account or log into your existing education portal account. Complete the quiz and course evaluation for your podcast episode. Your certificate will be available for download once completed.